Well, that's an amazing question. I like to think, well, I don't like to think, because, you know, when we give ceramics or something like that to a charity shop, we always hope they're going to a better home. I don't know whether it's helpful to think that those wonderful ceramics of a grandmother or somebody gone, or maybe just a plate we don't like is being smashed by somebody that needs that. Maybe it's all for a good cause still. As for the TVs and the washing machines, I mean, white goods are very expensive. Although fly tipping, particularly where I live in Glasgow, is such a problem. I think they could get some good business out of just taking those off the
Well, Lucy Holden, thank you very much for joining us. I think I've relieved my stress already. I've been joined by the very calm Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. What do you make of the idea of going to a rage room, throwing things around the studio? We're not allowed to do, of course.
Oh, aren't we? Gosh, that's news to us.
Oh, is it?
Is that what you've done
on a regular basis?
No, I think a rage room sounds fantastic.
Maybe we could all go.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make that the Christmas outing.
Christmas outing to a rage room.
Women only.
That's all we have time for. It sounds like it's women only. I'll be back tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Otherwise, I shall leave you in the care of these two wonderful women for this afternoon. Bye-bye.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Joe. Good afternoon. 2 o'clock. It is Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Coming up on our programme today, what does the mansion tax mean for homeowners and the housing market? Could there be a referendum on a united Ireland? And what on earth is turbo dating?
Let's get the news. Here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The business secretary has admitted that Labour's tax rises have led to an exodus of wealthy Britons. Peter Kyle says he accepts some of the decisions the party has made since taking office last year. Of course, some people to feel the need to leave. Rachel Reeves is expected to announce significant tax rises in her budget on Wednesday. She will hit more than 100,000 of Britain's most expensive properties with a surcharge of about £4,500. Tom Bill is head of UK residential research at the estate agency Knight Frank. He's told Times Radio that revaluing expensive houses could be time-consuming.
The problem is, the further up you go in terms of value of residential property, the more complicated it is to value. You get streets where the differences are greater, the nuances between individual properties are greater. It's a less sort of standard part of the housing market. So it has its own challenges, certainly, in terms of valuation.
Tory leader Kemi Badenoch says the Employment Rights Bill is an assault on flexible working that needs to be scrapped. She's been speaking at the CBI's annual conference ahead of the Chancellor's budget on Wednesday. She says the bill, which will give employees more rights, is the greatest cause for concern for businesses and blames it for stagnating growth.
Right now, Britain needs more people in work, more investment, more risk-taking, not more rules. We need to get Britain working again. That is how we pay for our NHS. That is how we fund defence. That is how we look after the vulnerable.
Donald Trump has said that something good just may be happening on talks to end the war in Ukraine. He's suggested on social media that big progress is being made. There are concerns, however, that a 28-point peace plan would be extremely difficult for Ukraine to accept. Talks are being held in Geneva and the Coalition of the Willing is meeting tomorrow. Sir Keir Starmer says things are moving in the right direction.
We are making progress, and that is a good thing. Everybody is absolutely focused on what we need to get out of this, and that is a just and lasting peace. Both of those words matter. It's got to be just, and obviously matters for Ukraine have to be determined by Ukraine. But it's also got to be lasting. It's got to endure. So that's the focus.
Two members of the House of Lords are set to be suspended over breaches of the Code of Conduct. In separate investigations, Lord Dannatt and Lord Evans of Watford were both found to have broken the rules on providing parliamentary services in return for payment or reward. And the musician Jimmy Cliff has died at the age of 81. He's credited as being one of the main voices to bring reggae to a global audience. His songs included Wonderful World, Beautiful People, and You Can Get It If You Really Want. He also starred in the 1972 crime drama The Harder They Come. His wife, Latifah Chambers, said he'd been suffering from pneumonia. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, a very good afternoon to you. 3 minutes past two, we'll have our own little musical tribute to Jimmy Cliff out of the 3:30 news. Only two sleeps to go. Then it is the big, beautiful budget, though, and the Times is across so much of what it might contain. So we will delve a little bit more into the mansion tax possibilities in a couple of moments' time. And we're going to look at polling, too, after 3 o'clock. If you had the choice between cutting public services or raising taxes, what would you like the Chancellor to do? And do you really know what fiscal headroom means? In this half an hour of the programme, though, we're also going to look at the stuff that money can't buy. Is it time for a kindness revolution? Well, we're going to talk to the founder of a project called Kissing It Better, which is aimed at tackling loneliness one kind act at a time. And it is one of the Times' Christmas appeal charities this year. Another great question for you in this hour of the programme. Do you need to be more honest when you start dating someone? Turbo dating is upon us kids. The idea is that you don't muck around with small talk about what films you like, whether you prefer cold drip coffee to French press. You should go straight in. Do you want kids? Should we live in the city? Who will pay most of the bills? All of the big stuff will be there. David Cameron as well on the front page of the Times today and some of the other papers has told us about his prostate cancer diagnosis. And we're going to discuss the efficacy of the PSA test. He says more men should have it. Not everybody agrees with that, but why? And also because it is Cultural Mondays on this programme, the effervescent Robbie Millen comes in. He's going to tell us about some modern releases, including one by Charles Dickens. And money as well on Mondays is always done with the fiscally relevant Adam Shaw. And of course, we will talk about the budget. There really has been talk of nothing else. And I wonder whether or not we will all feel better or worse when the time comes on Wednesday. That's what we're heading towards, Jane, isn't it?
Inexorably, yes. The book that Robbie's going to talk about, by the way, by Charles Dickens is seasonal favourite, A Christmas Carol, which is often on the, I think it's the GCSE syllabus, isn't it, on the strength that it's not very long. But is it any good?
I don't know. Robbie will tell us.
Robbie likes to go back to the classics, doesn't he?
Likes to go back to his childhood.
We are certainly the better for his intellectual input into this programme.
That's all coming next, or later on this show. We're here till four. You can get in touch, 0333 003 2353. A quick look at the most read stories on the Times website so far today. At number three, this is very sad, JFK's granddaughter, Tatiana Schlossberg, has terminal cancer at 35. Tragedy strikes again at the heart of the family of the president who was assassinated in Dallas 62 years ago. The second most read story, entrepreneurs are leaving the UK in droves, minister admits. The business secretary says tax rises have led to an exodus of the wealthy, but he claims others are attracted to Britain because of excitement in the economy. And the most read piece is Rachel Reeves to hit 100,000 properties with mansion tax to attempt to balance the books. The Chancellor will try to raise between 400 and 450 million from the levy, which will come, we're told, from revaluing properties in bands F, G and H. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription and you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
And a message straight in from Pete, who says, I run a small business making soft furnishings. We rely on people owning million-pound properties spending their money to keep our 20 staff safely in work. A mansion tax is a tax on tradespeople too. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us this afternoon, we'll take them on pretty much anything that we're talking about, even stuff we're not. We're 0333 003 2353 and we're Jane and Fee at times.radio.
Let's get to that story then, because there's no doubt a lot of people care about this. The Times is reporting today that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will hit 100,000 properties with a mansion tax to balance the government's books. This is, of course, still really in the realm of speculation that the budget is actually on Wednesday, but a lot of attention coming to this particular angle. The average charge for owners of properties worth more than £2 million will be £4,500, but some payments are going to be a lot larger. Lucien Cook is head of residential research at Savills. Would it be fair to say, Lucien Cook, that Savills are an upmarket property agency?
I don't think it's unfair. It's certainly one of the things that we do, and we do an awful lot of work in this space. And I think one of the things that we have seen over the period of the last 3 months, when there's been almost unprecedented levels of speculation around property taxation, is an increasing level of caution from those people in the market. Simply not really knowing what is around the corner is not a very good basis for people to make perhaps one of their biggest financial decisions of their life.
Are you based mostly in the south of England? Is that right?
Well, we're a national agent. We go up into Scotland, across into Wales, disproportionately, as you would expect, much like the top end of the property market, then we are represented in London and the South East.
OK. Now, the vast majority of people listening outside the south of England are going to think, well, OK, there aren't that many properties worth more than £2 million. This sounds pretty fair to me. These people are loaded. What's wrong with that thought?
Well, look, I think there's two big problems which successive advocates of a mansion tax or any form of property reform, property taxation, have come up against. And the first one, of course, is that if you just use a property value, you have no real regard to the difference between gross and net wealth. There are going to be a pretty significant proportion of people who have bought those properties who still have a mortgage, and they have to service that mortgage, and increasing their taxation will have an impact on their ability to do that in the future, or perhaps how much mortgage they can get in the future. And that, therefore, can act as a drag on the property market more generally. And the second one, of course, is that a lot of these properties, or these properties, are generally at the top of the housing ladder. And that means that people have graduated into those properties, and some people have been in them for a very long period of time. So again, the other main problem that you have with it is it doesn't really have regard to the situation of those people who are asset rich, no doubt about that, but they're cash poor. And of course, those tend to be the much older buyers whose financial circumstances were very different when they bought their house, and the value of their property was probably very different when they bought that house.
And this will mainly, one would assume, be elderly people?
Yeah, primarily that's more likely to be the older homeowners. And as we know, for those homeowners, there is a very significant emotional attachment to the home. That tends to be the big thing which makes them reluctant to move out of that property.
So this won't come in, we're told, until 2028. And this is all because they have to sort out the values. There's going to be an almighty series of ding-dongs.
One of the big pragmatic problems that you have here is you've got to work out which properties are worth more than £2 million. And of course, in an age where we have lots of big data and we have what are known as automated valuation models, basically chuck all of the information through some very serious computers and come see what comes out the other side. For a lot of housing stock in the UK, that's not a massive problem. But this is a very discerning market. Very small differences in a property can have quite a significant difference in the value which that property holds. And indeed, there's no real agreement across the industry as to how many houses there are above £2 million. Our estimate, which is based on the distribution of transactions, is around 145,000. That number will have fallen since the beginning of the year, given some of the uncertainties that we've seen within the market. The government have put it at 100,000. I think they're always going to be cautious because they don't want to come up short on the revenue raising from this. Mm. But equally, I was talking to Richard Donnell at Zupra earlier on today, and his figure using their automated valuation model is somewhat higher. So the valuation process itself is going to be quite tricky, and that at a time when the valuation office agency is going through change because it's being moved into HMRC on a cost saving drive. So there are some real issues just in terms of determining value.
Right. You're seriously saying there's actually a bureaucratic issue here. There aren't the people to do the work.
Well, that's right. And I suspect some of it is going to have to be outsourced. I would imagine, you know, if you start by looking at F, G and H properties, you are starting by valuing millions of properties, not hundreds of thousands, to get to that £100,000 figure. And that really is a reflection of the fact that these valuations within the council tax system are so outdated. I suspect they will narrow that down using some of the AVMs. They'll look for a margin of error, but then it's going to be a practical exercise. And it will be very interesting to see how the government approaches that and whether the taxpayer will have a right of appeal. Because what we think is going to happen is they go into bands. And if you're on the edge of a band, you know, you are going to be quite concerned as to which side of that you fall.
But do you agree that there need to be changes in the way property tax is handled in this country?
To a degree. I mean, I think we can all say that the property tax system is outdated. Council tax is right at the top of that. But
yeah, and it
I
goes back to what, the early 90s?
Yeah, 1991. So now I started my career back in 1993. And so it sort of predates my time. But when I started as a graduate surveyor, I was still doing some of these council tax valuation appeals. So that tells you exactly how long ago it was. I think the other issue with property taxes is generally what people do is talk about one tax in isolation. So they will say that there is a problem with council tax, but they won't necessarily have regard to the way that stamp duty operates. So council tax is broadly regarded as regressive in nature. Council tax broadly regressive in nature. Stamp duty highly progressive. So those £2 million plus properties, of which around two thirds are in London, about another 20% are in the southeast, are raising 22% of all residential stamp duty revenues. So that is over £2.2 billion a year on average for the last 3 years that we've got data. Compare that then to the £450 million that this measure is raising.
Okay.
And you can see that this is a very interwoven and complex process. It needs reform. But that reform is very difficult and complicated to do. And I think that's why we've seen so many measures proposed, and we've almost come back to this one.
Isn't it fairer, though, to have this kind of a tax than to have what was also mooted, which was a capital gains tax on primary residences, which would have definitely put money into the coffers of the Treasury? But many people from your profession said would really damage the housing market. This isn't going to damage the housing market, is it? People won't stop moving because of this tax, will they?
I don't think they will stop moving as a result of this tax. Some may find it more difficult to trade up the housing ladder as a result of it, so that could slightly suppress transactional activity. Some people who actually just say this is the straw that broke the camel's back, having regard to everything else that's going on, may be more inclined to bring their property to the market. The capital gains tax proposal was one that was always going to be very, very difficult to put to bed. And if you go back to 2014, George Osborne changed stamp duty at that point in time. It resulted in a big tax saving for the majority of the market, but not the top end. At that point, taxation went up. And since then, this top end of the market has been very price sensitive. So one of the problems that you had with capital gains tax was that it wasn't guaranteed that it was going to raise very much money because people hadn't seen a significant appreciation in the value of the asset since they bought it. The only people who had were the older homeowners. And of course, we know they are amongst the most reluctant to move. And if putting a tax on them was really just going to compound that issue. So that measure I always thought was going to be a very, very difficult one to put to bed.
It will be interesting to see what happens to Labour support in London, because actually Labour, unpopular in much of the rest of the country, still has quite a relatively high level of support in London. But this, as you've indicated, Lucian, is going to impact on homeowners in London.
Yeah, and you can see the way that some of this policy has evolved really reflects that. So it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about a tax on the 300,000 most expensive properties. That would have brought that threshold down to around 1.45 million. And the issue with that was it started to really hit into the middle class households within London whom it wasn't really going to be targeted at. And that is a reflection that you've got these big differentials in regional and local house prices. And it means that it is a very much a London weighted tax. And some of that will fall in those areas of London that have got high Labour support. Whether it's actually the Labour voters might be a different issue. But certainly in some of those areas.
And I know it's just, I don't expect sympathy from the rest of the country, but a £2 million house in London may not necessarily be, quotes, a mansion. I mean, it might just be a big terraced house.
Yeah, and in some cases that will look like a normal family house. Of course, £2 million on the face of it sounds like a very significant sum of money. And for the vast majority of the population, of course it is. But the reality is that you will go to parts of London, swathes of London that are dominated not by overseas buyers, but by domestic buyers for whom 2 million is your pretty typical terraced, possibly semi-detached family home.
Thank you very much, Lucian. Lucian Cook is head of residential research at Savills. It's fair to say people are exercised by this, aren't they, Fee?
They are. Nick says, Rachel, just put up income tax and move on. It's just ridiculous. And I say that as a higher rate payer. Good afternoon, says Keach. I keep hearing it's the people with the broadest shoulders who need to take the biggest burden. My question is, who are these people? And this one, who remains anonymous, how can a Band F flat in London, which hasn't been sold since the original valuation, be valued for current council tax? Surely a sale price has to be achieved before that can be assessed. I live in a London Band F flat worth £320,000, while my neighbour's flat is worth £700,000, and I work in a shop. It will be a muddle and a befuddle and a kerfuffle for quite some time if this does come in.
What you want to do, Fee, is sit back. I don't know what you're doing on Wednesday afternoon, but I'm going to sit back and listen to the words of wisdom coming from Andrew Neil and Joe Coburn right here on Times Radio.
Well, I'm definitely going to sit down for it.
We might all need to.
Okay, coming up, we're going to hear from a charity whose small acts of kindness make a big difference to elderly patients in hospital. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The Budget 2025 on Times Radio. This Wednesday afternoon, Hugo Rifkind will bring you the budget statement from Chancellor Rachel Reeves, live from 12:30, followed at 1 by Joe Coburn and Andrew Neil with a special budget programme featuring expert analysis on all the announcements. Then from 4, John Pienaar brings you Drive Live from Westminster with a full roundup of all the political reaction. The Budget 2025, this Wednesday afternoon, on Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Nice. Direct Line just sorted me a courtesy van. Well, they're fixing mine after my accident. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like clients paying you on time. All done.
Brilliant. Your invoice is all paid up, left you 5-star reviews. Oh, and a bit extra in there for staying late that time. And I baked this cake for you too.
Nice.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Comprehensive cover required. Courtesy van limited for up to 21 days if your van is written off, stolen, or you use your own repairer. Excludes windscreen claims.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wix have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wix.co.uk.
Robert says it'll be most appealing to listen to the post-budget squealing of the champagne socialists in their ivory towers in London. Nafisa says, I absolutely agree. Just put up income tax, take the flak and move on. And this one from Suzanne, Band F affects so many small flats in London, which are sold at well below £1 million. Keep them coming. We are 0333 003 2353 and we love to hear from you. Now, is it time for a kindness revolution after witnessing examples of careless care in hospitals, including errors with medications and poor communication with relatives? Jill Fraser decided that enough was enough. She decided to do something about it and set up Kissing It Better, a project that's now grown into a national movement tackling loneliness and transforming the way we care for people, one thoughtful act at a time. And this year, The Times and The Sunday Times have chosen Kissing It Better as one of the three charities they'll champion in their 2025 Christmas appeal. I'm delighted to say that Jill Fraser is with us. A very good afternoon from us, Jill.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be here.
Just tell us a little bit more about your story. What made you take the leap from being upset by what you were seeing to actually starting something yourself?
Well, I've had a bit of history with being involved in a charity before. I'm a nurse by training. It's a very complicated story, but that's the basics. I started as a nurse by training. I then went into another career later on, although it was related. But then when my daughter had a very severe peanut allergy, I decided I wanted to do something about it, and I joined a small charity and realised that a small group of people could make a big difference. And 20 years on from that, when my mother was so ill and I was by her bedside, I thought, I can either get angry or I can try and do something about it again. So together with a friend, we set up Kissing It Better. We wouldn't have called it that in 2025 because of all the political correctness, but it's based on that simple act of kindness. A child who falls over, screams and runs to the person they most trust, and a simple act of kindness, and they don't need any medical or surgical intervention. In most cases, they're ready to get back on that climbing frame. That's the basis of it, really.
So how do you then translate that good intention into something that people know when to do it and how to do it?
So sitting by her bedside, I noticed that there was a lot of lovely good ideas that went on by her bedside, but the issue was they weren't being shared. It wasn't because people were holding them into themselves. They just never thought to connect with the next bay on the ward, let alone the next ward or the next hospital. And so we wondered if we put out a message to everybody saying, if you've seen, created or experienced a simple idea that's made the world of difference to somebody, could you tell us about it, as long as it's not worth any money? We didn't want to be seen to be pinching other people's ideas. And we basically got the word out, and because I had links with the media in some ways, we managed to get quite a lot of the word out, and hundreds of people contacted us with ideas, and we populated a website and basically suggested that people looked on it if their loved ones are in hospital. What happened from there was I realised quite quickly that people who come home from a day looking after their loved one in hospital or really exhausted at the end of a caring process don't want to go on a website, they want to relax in front of the telly. So we changed the model slightly and we started to work with hospitals to basically drive those ideas into hospitals in all sorts of different ways. And when I talk about simple ideas, I'm not talking about kissing, by the way, it's got nothing to do with it, it's just an expression. But if somebody's had really major surgery or they're desperately ill, often when the visitors go in the evening to see them, it's not the, they don't talk about their MRI scan or their complicated process. They'll say, you see that porter over there? He was the person that got me a really comfy pillow when I was taken down for a process. You see that receptionist over there? She remembered it was my birthday, knew I loved daffodils and got me a card with daffodils on the front of it. It is those simple things that really soften the experience in hospital, and it's what people remember more than anything else, I believe.
Is there a problem that we should acknowledge here, Jill, in that some of those things should just be within a day's work if you are looking after patients in hospital?
I totally think it should be part of a day's work. I nursed for many years, and I totally would want to make it part of my day's work. I'm somebody who never stops talking, but I'm always thinking about, while I'm doing one procedure, how can I lighten it by distracting somebody or by talking about other things and thinking about those little things. But the reality is the world's become quite process-driven in some ways. There seems to be much more paperwork around, and it's finding the time to make that happen. And we do teach hospital staff, as well as school children from the age of 4 right up to 25, people doing postgraduate medicine. They do our courses, and the course is the same for everybody. Literally, we've had consultants come onto our courses, and I've always been quite sort of respectful of that and said, gosh, I'm sure I can't teach you anything. But the reality is they'll listen and they'll say to me often halfway through when I've said, are you sure this is okay? I'm sure you could use some of it for your students, even if you know it all yourself. And they go, listen, I don't know some of these things on these simple acts that I could be doing and I should be doing. But what worries me is I do know that some of these simple things I should be doing and I simply don't do it anymore. It's a kind of wake up call, because actually it's such, you know, when you go into a hospital and it's so sterile, it's so, you know, it's a very clinical environment. I think it's those simple acts of kindness that really make the most difference to patients.
And Jill, this is such a huge question and we've only got about 3 minutes left, but I'll punt it anyway. Why have we forgotten those simple acts of kindness? We know what it means when somebody acts kindly towards us. Are we fearful of getting involved in somebody else's life now? Is that part of the problem?
Gosh, that's a good question. The answer is I've wondered it constantly myself. I don't think it's rocket science to be able to do it, but I think people are so driven by process these days, and they walk around. Sometimes if you go into a care home, somebody's walking around with an iPad and ticking a box every time somebody has a drink or somebody takes 10 steps across the room. And I think we've got to really roll back from that a bit and think about what are the things that are really going to make a difference to somebody's day. To be thought, we use, you know, kindness is a good word, but we use the word thoughtfulness. How can you thoughtfully think? Every patient is different. What would be the big thing that would make a change for the positive in their day to day? And it might be, I can remember, if you know, if somebody supported a particular football team and I'd watched the match the night before on the telly or heard the result, just going in there and having a bit of banter with them first thing in the morning. It's a distraction. And I think these days people are so driven by their devices, and I think people are so driven in so many ways by that, that they're not always thinking outside the box of all the multitude of things that you can do, that not only makes it better for the patients, it makes it better for the staff. Much better for the staff if there's a bit of banter going on or a bit of chat and a bit of those. Whenever we do a good deed for somebody, often the person that is the giver of that good deed feels better than the person who receives it. It's a win-win situation. So we are championing across the hospitals that we teach and the young people that we connect with in the community, who we bring in teams day after day after day, all highly supervised, to give their gift to those patients. So they might be having a chat, but they might sing. If they're good at dancing, they might dance. The range of things that we do is huge, but it is to make people think, good heavens, how surprising that this happened on the ward this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And the legacy of that visit means that when we go in, it's often silent, and when we leave, there is a buzz in that ward that lasts for maybe a couple of hours afterwards, just as if you've been to a concert in the evening, you're singing the songs on the bus on the way home. We want to leave a legacy of an uplift of mood, and that's what we aim to do.
So if people were to donate when the Christmas appeal here at the Times and the Sunday Times is launched, what would that money then be spent on?
At training, mostly. We are training lots and lots of our teams to become trainers so that we can train more and more students in schools and colleges and right the way down. We even work with children in nursery schools now from the age of sort of 3.5+, because it's those simple things that they can do, a little picture for granny when you go and visit them, or taking something into the hospital if a relative isn't well. Those simple acts of kindness need to be thought about, but they need to be delivered. It's no good. We always say it's no good thinking about doing something. You've got to actually follow it through, and you will be rewarded by seeing the delight that that person feels when they go, oh, that's so thoughtful of you. How kind that you thought of me in these difficult times to do that gesture, to have that gesture, to be that kind and to thoughtfully make a difference.
Jill, lovely stuff. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. Jill Fraser is the Chief Executive and Co-Founder of Kissing It Better. It may be too soon, but I wish you a very happy Christmas. Oh, she's gone there. She actually said it. And Nick says, give this woman a gong. She went down very well. Thank you very much to her. Michael says, we're back on mansion taxes. It's high time the outdated council tax bands were increased. Those in bands A, B, C and D pay far too much, whilst those in mansions, at the moment, they're paying a pittance. That's the view of Michael in Hitchin. 0333 003 2353. We are still just about, what is it now, 46 hours away from what is actually in the budget. But that's not going to stop us talking a great deal about what might be in the budget, because that's how we're rolling this afternoon. There will be more later, won't there?
There certainly will.
Yes, more later.
We're going to talk about fiscal headroom and give you a little bit of a test as to what you really know about that phrase.
Right. Pulses absolutely racing across the home counties. Coming up, could there ever be a referendum on whether or not the people of the island of Ireland would like a united Ireland? That is after the latest news headlines from Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The business secretary has admitted that people wanting to start a company are leaving Britain, quote, in droves. Peter Kyle says many have gone to the US because the conditions were not right in the UK. He says it's concerning that some entrepreneurs feel they have to leave in order to succeed. Donald Trump has said that something good just may be happening on talks to end the war in Ukraine. He has suggested on social media that big progress is being made. Talks are being held in Geneva. Sir Keir Starmer says things are moving in the right direction.
Along with President Macron, I've been leading the Coalition of the Willing, which is a group of countries that have put in place support for Ukraine, particularly capability. And I'm now planning that we will meet virtually tomorrow. So we will host a coalition of the willing call to further discuss the progress that is being made and I hope can be made towards the thing that matters above all else, which is a just and lasting peace.
The police watchdog says four Northamptonshire officers should face misconduct proceedings over the handling of abuse allegations made by a woman who was later found dead. 24-year-old Harshita Brella was discovered in a car boot in Ilford in Essex last November. A manhunt continues to find her husband, who's believed to be in India. And a woman's been arrested in Birmingham in connection with terror offences. The 29-year-old was detained in the Aston area of the city this morning. She's being held on suspicion of encouraging terrorism and spreading terrorist publications. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Add water to your will and know that from that single drop, life will grow, communities will flourish, a better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
What good is sitting?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at KitKat.club.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar joins us. He'll be on air from 4 o'clock this afternoon. John, what have you got?
Well, Ukraine, the talks have been going on. Apparently, the Ukrainian team were pulled out of the Geneva talks. That was officials, although Marco Rubio was involved as well. And where we are, who knows now? The president of the United States is talking about great progress, and the leader of Ukraine is sounding optimistic. I suppose he has to sound optimistic, because once he sounds as if he's throwing in the towel, then it's kind of as good as over. But what we had before the weekend were terms put together by Russia and the American side, which amounted to a Ukrainian surrender. And then the Ukrainians said no, not unpredictably. And the European friends said no. And there were all these talks we've seen over the last 24 hours. And here we are. But where are we? Are we going to head back to a point where, in the end, Putin, having just pushed everyone and Donald Trump gone in on that and then being pushed back, we're just where we are with the war going on and Putin seemingly content for that to be the case? It may be another circular dance, but people are talking optimistically. And maybe we'll see. So I'll talk about where that is going. The BBC, the chair of the BBC, and Robbie Gibb, who's now a famous man on the board of the BBC, are giving evidence to a parliamentary committee. That's going to be happening while we're on, so we'll keep track of that. I'll talk to Roger Mosey, who you may remember from the old days, a former senior boss at the BBC. And later on, after six, Tim Montgomery and Rachel Cunliffe will join us to chat and to converse and to duke it out.
Duke it out. I love that.
Love that. Would I duchess it out with somebody?
Well, it's duke as in fist.
Oh, how is it spelled?
Put up the deep, same way, D-U-K-A, but it's dukes as in put up your dukes.
Whole new world.
It's right. An Americanism, I think.
Oh, how awful. Right, John, thank you very much. John Pienaar, live on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7.
Oh, we went very pugilistic there, didn't we, Jane?
Yes, we did.
Calm down, dear.
Yes. OK, I'm... Totally zen now. I'm going to ask, is a referendum on a united Ireland a possibility? And if it did take place, what would the implications be for the island of Ireland and indeed for us? Two leading journalists on both sides of the Irish border have got together to analyse the pros and cons. They've written a book together called For and Against a United Ireland, and they are in the for camp, Fintan O'Toole, the author and Irish Times columnist, and against, Sam McBride, the Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph. Fintan O'Toole, first of all, welcome to the programme. Tell us a bit about your decision to write the book and the timing of it.
Yes, so I should say we're not, it's not me for and Sam against.
Is it more complicated?
The idea is very different. We're both trying to argue, so we both argue for and against.
Right.
So what we're both trying to do is leave our own opinions out of this, which is not easy for a loudmouth like me particularly. And to try as objectively as possible, and, you know, of course, that's never entirely possible, but we genuinely tried to engage people in a process of just trying to think about what would this look like, what kinds of questions should you want to ask as a potential voter? Does anybody really have a good answer to those questions? So the situation, as I'm sure most listeners know, is that, you know, Irish unity is sort of accepted as a legitimate possibility under the Belfast Agreement of 1998. You know, the UK has signed up to that. It's a border poll is to be triggered whenever the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland is of the opinion that there might be a majority in favour of United Ireland. It's a bit vague. But nonetheless, this is there as a sort of concrete possibility, as it were. And I think what we hoped to do was to just really get people thinking about this, because it's a very big deal. You know, it would involve huge changes to the whole political architecture of these islands. It would involve, you know, an awful lot of money, an awful lot of changes to the way in which things like education and healthcare and welfare systems work. And really, I think both Sam and I would agree that the work hasn't been done yet to lay out what that might look like.
Okay, Sam, why hasn't it been done?
It's a very good question, and there's not a straightforward answer to it. I mean, I think if I was to guess at what the answer is, that a bit like the people who are arguing for Brexit, if you start saying to people, this is a very difficult and a very complex thing to do, we still believe in it, we still believe it should be done, but it's not quite as straightforward as you might have thought. That's not necessarily what's going to get you over the line in getting people to vote yes for this. And so I suppose my motivation behind this is that this is a serious idea. It's a very credible idea, but it needs to be taken seriously. And that is something that is necessary for people who want Irish unity, but it's actually quite awkward for them as well. And so there are people in Sinn Féin, for instance, now the biggest party both north of the border in Ireland, but also on the whole island right now. There are people there who talk about this constantly. They are calling for a border poll by 2030. They are constantly trying to push this forward. But once you get beyond them saying, let's have the conversation, and you say, okay, let's have the conversation, they tend to clam up. They don't really want to talk about what would the flag be? What would the anthem be? Mm. Would we go back into the Commonwealth? Would it be a single unitary state? Would there be a federal system? So we really haven't got beyond the foothills of this debate.
It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, stuff like the flag, I mean, it's hugely significant, a flag. And the assumption would be, I suppose, that the tricolour would bite the dust or something would be added to it. What do you think, Sam?
Well, some people just take that for granted because they think that this would have to be a new country, it would have to be a compromise, it would have to be radically different to simply bolting the north onto the south. That sort of old classical Irish sense of what might be the single state on this island. However, when there's polling done on this, and we're part of this bigger project, the Irons project being run from Dublin, looking at lots of these big questions, doing lots of research into it, and when you ask people people in the South about this. They tend to say, we're absolutely in favour of unity, but when you ask about the flag, no, they don't want to change it. The anthem, no, they don't want to change it. Don't want to rejoin the Commonwealth, don't want to pay more tax for it. So it's a very shallow commitment right now to unity. That means that I think when we get to this point, whenever that might be, we don't really know how people are going to go, because once they think about it deeply, we really have no concept of where they'll ultimately end up here.
That's really, to people, I think, in this part of Britain, it seems astonishing that there isn't an absolute passion in the Republic of Ireland for reunification as soon as possible. But Fintan, is Sam right? Are there some people who are more than ambivalent about it all in the Republic?
I would say there's plenty of passion and not a huge amount of serious thought. And this isn't to be snobbish about passion. You know, emotion is part of politics. It's part of identity. But I think it's precisely because I think most people in the South think of it as an identity issue that you get polling like people saying, you know, roughly about 2/3 of people say they would vote for United Ireland tomorrow. But then you say, well, would you pay more tax?
Why would they have to pay more tax?
Well, they'd have to pay more tax because Northern Ireland is currently very heavily subsidised from London. So as part of the UK, it receives a big check every year. There's, you know, some argument about exactly how much we're talking about, but something like £12 billion a year. And it gets that because basically Northern Ireland costs more to run than it earns itself in terms mm-hmm. of taxation. And, you know, there are obvious reasons for that. When Northern Ireland was set up, it was a very rich part of the UK. Belfast was one of the most developed cities in the world. But, you know, Northern Ireland suffered badly from deindustrialization. It also, suffered, of course, hugely during 30 years of a terrible conflict. So economically, the North is now less developed than the South. And this has, you know, pretty big implications for people in the South. And so what happens when you ask them, would you pay more taxes? They say no. And then you ask them, well, you know, would you change the flag? No. Would you change the national anthem? No. You know, and it seems that people haven't really thought very deeply about this. You know, they want it. It's sort of the immediate thought in their heads when you say, you know, Ireland, this is a really good thing. And of course, it may well be, you know, I perfectly understand those sentiments. But you need a lot of compromises to be made, and you need maybe perhaps some sacrifices to be made. And I think it's those things that are not necessarily in people's minds at the moment.
Right. And Sam, in Northern Ireland, we know that obviously there's a substantial body of folk who are very determined to stay part of Britain, Great Britain. But there are others, including presumably some Catholics, who are actually not bothered particularly about whether or not they join the Republic. Are there Catholics who would prefer to keep things how they are?
Yes, there certainly are. And if you go back 10 years or so prior to the Brexit vote, this was basically a settled question in Northern Ireland. It's never completely settled because there are people who aspire to change the status quo. But there was a sense that even lots of people who might be nationalist, might be Catholic, might have some long-term sense that they want to be in a different state, they were not in any way urgent about that. They were settled. They thought that things were getting better. They thought that the wider UK was going in broadly a right direction from their perspective, and that was completely upended by Brexit. However, things have plateaued a bit for nationalism over the last couple of years. The sort of Brexit pain that lots of Irish nationalists thought they were going to bear, a very hard border at the land border, simply has not materialised. The land border is as free today as it was beforehand for most people. There is an issue for some trade across that border in services, but not in goods. And the real pain of Brexit has been borne by the pro-union population north of the border. They now have this border in the Irish Sea. It makes it much harder to get goods across that. Lots of companies now are simply not selling to Northern Ireland. They're treating it as a place apart. And so that means that we're in this sort of no man's land here, where there is all to play for, and people can make the best arguments, but we haven't really got beyond this point of saying border poll, yes or no, unity, yes or no. What we're trying to do here is look look at what would be the good bits of this, of getting a single Irish state. What would be the bad bits? What would we gain? What would we lose? And it's very messy and it's very complicated when you get into that.
Right. Okay. And just very briefly from both of you, what are the chances of United Ireland in the next 20 years? Fintan?
I think there's a reasonable chance of it. You know, the direction of travel is fairly clear. And then we just don't know what might trigger a border poll.
Sam?
I think it is unlikely, but it's by no means out of the question. And I think that what struck me writing this is that simply by having the status quo, unionism is this massive advantage. A bit like Scotland, it takes a huge effort to persuade people to change a country. And that's not something that we're currently in a situation where there's a credible argument right now as we speak to do that.
Thank you very much for your time. Sam McBride, Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph, and Fintan O'Toole, author and Irish Times columnist.
Now, don't ever say that we don't provide variety for you on the afternoon show. What on earth is turbo dating? And could it be for you? That's where we're going to head next. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. It's 12 minutes to three. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Early Breakfast with Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
Start the morning bright and early with me, Rosie Wright, to discover the day. I have a first look at the news.
We've got far more patients needing help and far fewer GPs to deliver it.
The business headlines.
We've seen signs that we could actually avoid a recession.
Sports and, of course, politics too.
The government really are coming under criticism, particularly from the House of Lords, that they didn't put a much more binding agreement in place.
Early Breakfast with Rosie Wright.
Tomorrow morning from 5 on Times Radio. Radio.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Life's like a photo album. Mine bring back so many memories. That's a street party on VE Day. Me, 3 years old. Oh, here's me, 17, teddy boy. Our wedding. Didn't my Shirley look lovely? Holiday in Devon when the boys were small. They tower over me now. Oh, now these are the more recent ones on my phone. Oh, that's me and Kate enjoying a game of cards. She's my care professional from home instead. Kind, funny and very good at gin rummy. Since Shirley passed away, Kate comes to the house most days to help with the things I can't manage so well now. She's great company. I mean, the boys visit me most weekends, but they can't be here all the time. So home instead have really helped. I have the best quality care, but in my own home, from Kate. She's wonderful. Though she will have to let me win at cards now and again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's now 10 minutes to three. This song by Olivia Dean carries a clue to our next story.
The same way, but I can't tell with you sometimes.
Well, it is Olivia Dean singing Man I Need, but should you be extremely upfront if you're dating and looking for the person you feel you need? Well, The Times carries a story today on so-called turbo dating, written by assistant literary editor Ceci Browning. She's with us now. Greetings from us. Tell us a little bit more about turbo dating.
Hello, yes. So turbo dating is something I read about and thought, hold on, this is what I've been doing. I kind of didn't know it. It's one of those strange dating trends that has a interesting name and that people might not realise they are doing already. But the idea of turbo dating is that you basically skip straight to the good stuff. You kind of get out all the personal information that you need to and harvest all of their personal information, which might be relevant to whatever you would like from them. And then you decide quite quickly whether you're going to continue or stop, rather than this kind of, oh, do I like them? Do I not like them? Maybe I'll see them again.
Within 20 minutes or half an hour?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how efficient you are. But you kind of ask big questions to begin with. So rather than saying, you know, what's your favourite colour and what's your favorite, what do you like to eat, you're kind of saying, okay, well, where do you see yourself in 5 years, and what are your career ambitions, and would you like to get married at some point? Even the, you know, this is someone you might have met on an app, or a friend might have set you up, but you're quite, they're quite new to you, but the idea is that you kind of dive in head first.
So presumably this only really works if you both know that you're doing this, because if you've got someone who's just come for a gentle paddle in the shadows, yeah, and you're just diving in from the high diving board, that might not be a perfect evening.
Yes, that's very true. I think it kind of comes from people my age are sick of dating apps, where a lot of it, you can kind of talk to someone for weeks on a dating app, messaging back and forth, one message a day, and not get anywhere. So I think this is a kind of resistance to that. And I feel like most people are on the same page. They're moving away from the kind of chit-chat, and they actually want to just find out whether the person who's sat in front of them is on the same page they are. And you're right, sometimes someone isn't interested in that or just wants a gentle conversation. And in that case, maybe the date ends in 30 minutes. But I feel like part of it comes with this new confidence to be, after 30 minutes, be able to say, okay, this isn't for me. Thank you. I had a lovely evening, but I'm going to go home and put my pyjamas on.
Sure. Do you think that it works for people who might just be a little bit shy?
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that if you're shy, it's more difficult. But I also think that on a date is naturally a scenario where you might feel shy or you might be anxious. Even people who've been on lots and lots of dates and kind of are very familiar with dating apps, they still get nervous before they go on a first date. It's a scary thing turning up to meet someone you've never met before. So I think that already in a date, especially a first date situation, you have to make yourself be brave and be confident, and you kind of have to have a word with yourself in the mirror before and go, okay, it's going to be all right. They're just a human being. It'll be fine. So I think shy people already have to overcome that. And the difference is between asking a kind of simple, slightly boring question and asking the big questions, actually the jump from one to the other isn't that big.
Yeah. What about the notion that actually you might fall in love with someone who can change your mind about something? I mean, especially when you're quite young, you might think that you know exactly what you want from life, but life throws things at you and it might not be, you know, the same answer kind of 5 years down the line. So do you worry at all that this is taking some of the kind of the lovely mystery out of life?
Well, I think that turbo dating, you know, so-called turbo dating, isn't a kind of religion. You don't have to stick to it at all times, at all costs. And I think there's definitely an argument if you're sat opposite someone and they don't have the answers you would like to the questions you're asking them, but you get on with them and they're interesting and they challenge you, you know, it doesn't mean that you can't see them again or you wouldn't see them again. I think it's one of the things that turbo dating is kind of useful for, is making you evaluate your own values and think, actually, what are the things that are important to me?
Yeah. What are the, should we do a top five list of questions that you'd ask on a turbo date? So in no particular order, what would those be?
Yeah, okay. In no particular order, because I will warm them up with some easy questions first.
What's your easiest?
My easiest question. I like to know what people's parents' names are.
Oh, I love that.
Because okay. I think that then, as soon as you're talking about your parents, you feel quite comfortable and everyone loves their parents.
Well, it depends. Well, not everyone.
Well, not everyone. But I'd like to think that lots of people have lovely families that they're proud of. So
have you got any names on that list that immediately you
think, we would be like, no way. Thanks for a nice evening. I'm off. No, there's no wrong answer to that question. That's why it's an easy one.
Okay, so we've got that. We've got parents' names. What else?
But the big questions, I'd say, I like to know where people think they're going to be in 5 years. And if that's, you know, in the deepest, darkest Peru, like Paddington Bear, on adventures, that's fine. I'll come with you. But I like to know whether it's that or whether they want to have been promoted two or three times in their job and they're going to be in the same flat wherever they live.
Move from zone four to zone three.
Where are you going to be in the world? What are you going to be doing in 5 years' time? That's a big question, which can be a scary one, but it's a good one.
Would you ask the kids question?
Yeah, I do, actually, because I've been in relationships with people that didn't have the same opinion as me, and it is quite a big obstacle. You have to get to it eventually.
Yeah, of course you do, but I always thought that was the classic, you're frightened, let's say it is a heteronormative encounter, I always thought that was the question that would potentially frighten him off.
Yeah, I think so, but
even if actually he did want children but wasn't prepared to admit it.
I mean, I think it depends how you ask it. I think if you say, you know, would you like to have children right away and would you like me to be the one that
what
has
them? What
should
we call them?
Let's do it. How many do you want and where are we going to live and what school are they going to go to? Yeah, you're probably going to scare the person.
Do you know what? I think it's equally valid in a gay dating
framework as well. I mean, you know, there is all kinds of ways that you can become parents now. So
yeah, absolutely.
It's good to know whether the little ones are on the horizon.
Mm. And I mean, whoever you are or whatever you're doing, it still changes your life having children, right? So that's why it's important, is because it does, it's a kind of fork in the road where you go in one direction rather than the other direction.
Yeah. Do you ask questions kind of about more cultural lifestyle-y things?
Yes, I mean, sometimes I wouldn't want someone who isn't interested in any kind of like exercise or physical activity, because that's a big part of my life. I think for lots of young people who are trying to avoid, you know, they spend 9 to 5 on a screen, they then want to go for a long run or go for a cycle or swim or whatever it is. Most of my friends have some kind of sport that they do, and it's nice. It doesn't have to be the same sport. We don't have to go for a run together every time, but it's nice. That's a kind of big thing that, you know, someone looks after themselves.
And is there any question, and this is such a tough one, is there any question that you actually do really want to ask, but you're not quite brave enough, even on a turbo date, to punt it out there?
Someone actually asked me a great question on a date recently, which I would be scared to ask, but which has stayed in my head. He asked me, what's your favourite red flag? So normally... normally, you kind of, you know, red flags are things that you avoid. But what his question, what he meant by that was, what thing that you know is bad for you and that you know that you should avoid, are you seeking out and going for? Mm. And that's a scary question, because that really makes you kind of have to be like, actually, you know, am I picking the wrong people? What about them is wrong? Why am I doing that? So that's a big, scary question, which I haven't asked, but I think it's a really good one.
I think that's a fantastic question. And, you know, when you watch all the love reality shows, you know, when quite often you'll see women say, oh, I always go for the bad boys, silly me. And you just think, yeah, no, don't go for the bad, don't go for the bad boys. Because look what keeps on happening to you. You know, there's nothing great about a bad girl or a bad boy, really, is there?
But being able to put your finger on what it is that you like about bad boys,
well,
or
you shouldn't
bad girls
do that on
the
first date anyway, for goodness sake.
Yes.
Can I just say, bring in Neil, who says, my first question on a turbo date, do you pay the mansion tax? I mean, tell you what, Ceci, that's what you should go for.
Yeah, that's perhaps a better technique.
Yeah, which council tax band are you? Should we get to the nitty-gritty? Council tax bands. Right, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. And on the programme, in the next hour, what are the polls saying ahead of the budget? And what, honestly, do we really know this? What is fiscal headroom? And we'll get the very best book recommendations from The Times and Sunday Times literary editor, Force of Nature, Robbie Millen, with us at around about 3:35. The news at 3 now, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The business secretary has admitted that Labour's tax rises have led to an exodus of wealthy Britons. Peter Kyle says he won't duck the fact that taxes have risen and loopholes have been closed for non-doms. In her budget on Wednesday, Rachel Rees will hit more than 100,000 of Britain's most expensive properties with a surcharge of about £4,500. Lucian Cook is head of residential research at the estate agency Savills. He's told Times Radio what's wrong with a mansion tax.
If you just use a property value, you have no real regard to the difference between gross and net wealth. There are going to be a pretty significant proportion of people who have bought those properties who still have a mortgage and they have to service that mortgage, and increasing their taxation will have an impact on their ability to do that in the future, or perhaps how much mortgage they can get in the future. And that therefore can act as a drag on the property market more generally.
The Prime Minister says progress is being made in talks on a peace plan for Ukraine. European officials have raised concerns, though, about parts of Donald Trump's plan, such as Kyiv ceding territory to Russia and being banned from joining NATO. Addressing Swedish MPs, Volodymyr Zelensky has set out his red lines.
Respect for human life, no changing borders by force, and no spheres of influence. Applied term used to cover the desire to dominate other nations and wage wars of aggression.
Here, the police watchdog says 4 Northamptonshire officers should face misconduct proceedings over the handling of abuse allegations made by a woman who was later found dead. 24-year-old Harshita Brella was discovered in a car boot in Ilford in Essex last November. A manhunt continues to find her husband, who's believed to be in India. Two peers will be suspended from the House of Lords after an undercover sting found they had breached the code of conduct. Lord Dannatt faces 4 months off and Lord Evans of Watford 5 months off for providing parliamentary services for financial gain. It follows investigations triggered by journalists. David Cameron has revealed he was treated for prostate cancer and has since been given the all clear. He's now joining calls for a targeted screening programme. And Jimmy Cliff, one of the pioneers of reggae music, has died at the age of 81. Best known for hits including You Can Get It If You Really Want and Many Rivers to Cross, he helped bring Jamaican music to a global audience. Speaking at the turn of the century, he said his music had gradually evolved over time.
We know that it's coming from, like you say, what was called ska, then to rocksteady. When it became known as reggae, that name kind of stuck. So we went off into different eras of reggae, like rubber dub, like ragamuffin, and now it's dancehall.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker,
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So many of you have got thoughts about turbo dating. If you want to read Ceci's piece, it is in the Times today. She goes on a date with a Stetson-wearing Texan and tells us all about how turbocharged it was. It's a very good read. Paul says, dear Jane and Fee, my mum and dad's names were Sid and Nancy. Now, there's a talking point. That's one for the ages, isn't it, Paul? Colin from Devon says, it sounds like a job interview to me, really. Well, I suppose it is, isn't it?
Well, yes, because really? It's a role. Yeah, it's an important
one. Will says on turbo dating, if I was scared before the date, I'd be catatonic within 5 minutes of this date. Not that I advocate turgid dating, but blimey, even her flick might run for the hills. I quite like the idea of turgid dating. I'm sure that there are people who'd sign up to
her
that.
Her flick? That's another reference to Nancy Hepburn.
Right, okay. Quite far back. Ahead of this week's budget, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has floated various tax increases in the name of increasing the government's fiscal headroom. But what exactly does that mean? We're joined by Jack Barnett, economics correspondent for The Times. Right. Pay attention, everybody. Sit up at the back. Here we go. What exactly is fiscal headroom?
Afternoon, everyone. So it's I'm going to caveat this slightly. It's very much dependent on what fiscal rules the Chancellor sets at the time. And they, at the moment, have kind of varied on some iteration of getting debt falling in some specific year, normally in about 5 years' time. So the current fiscal rules that we've got at the moment is Rachel Reeves must fund all day-to-day government spending. So that's things like, you know, paying doctors and keeping, you know, MRI machines running in NHS, all the sort of day-to-day things the government has to do. It kind of strips out the long-term big project stuff, so like public investments, like, you know, third runway Heathrow, stuff like that. That's stripped out of that measure. And in 5 years' time, she's got to fund all of that spending solely on tax revenues. That's kind of where we're at the moment. That's exactly what she's going to try and do on Wednesday. That sort of shifts around a little bit between fiscal events. And the estimate of how much headroom the Chancellor's got depends on how much the OBR thinks the economy is going to grow in 5 years' time and also how much tax revenue the government's going to take. The actual definition of headroom itself is the difference between how much tax revenue the government's going to get in 5 years compared to how much it's spending in that 5 years. If tax revenues is higher, that little wedge is your headroom, and then if it's vice versa, i.e. your revenues are lower than your spending, then you're in deficit. Mm.
If the fiscal rules are self-imposed and the targets in a way are self-imposed, then why can't they just be changed? And are they changed? It's just we can't see them changing.
They are changed quite frequently, actually, but not massively in terms of the definition. So we got a small tweak in the budget last year to the fiscal rules. This is where we are going to have to go a little bit technical here. So the Chancellor last year essentially changed the definition of debt, which we target in the fiscal rules, to something, I can't remember if you can remember the acronym that for it, but do you remember the snuffle debate in October last year? Basically, it was a new measure of debt, which was a little bit more, it sort of took into account a greater base of the government's assets. And then in 5 years' time, that debt fell a little bit quicker than on the previous measure of our debt before that. That was a small change to the fiscal rules. And then she put in another fiscal rule on top of that, which was this funding day-to-day spending with all tax revenue. So that's kind of become the main binding fiscal rule now. And then when you hear all these sort of, you know, these warnings of a fiscal black hole and, you know, there's 30-odd billion pounds of tax rises coming down the line, that's because the economic forecast has changed quite rapidly since the previous fiscal statement, which was in March time. It's deteriorated quite sharply since then. It means that the OBR thinks that the government is not going to raise as much in tax as it thought previously in 5 years' time. That's pushed the headroom from £9.9 billion surplus down to about a £10 billion deficit. Chancellor needs to replenish that with tax increases. And then she also wants to leave herself a little bit of a buffer after that as well, so you probably get a bit more than the £10 billion in tax increases on Wednesday.
Jane, I'm going to ask you to show your workings in the margin and you can explain all this back to me later. Perception is sometimes nine-tenths of reality, isn't it, Jack? So where do you think we are at the moment with our understanding of fiscal headroom and the possibilities that that gives all of us to believe that we can live a better life in this country?
I think it's, you're right to go down to, you know, like anything with economics, we can get bogged down in the numbers and the definitions and the sort of technical analysis, but it's almost like the broad brush thing. It's like, you know, it's like, is this, are fiscal rules a good thing? Is having fiscal headroom, you know, in and of itself a good thing to do? And I think there are risks on two sides of it. So, you know, if the Chancellor goes very hard on Wednesday and raises taxes by more than what we're currently expecting, I think we're sort of expecting around about £20 or £30 billion worth of tax rises, little small ones, which are going to get her to that figure. If she goes a bit further than that to increase the fiscal headroom, she does face a trade-off because, you know, if she increases taxes quite sharply, that might slow down the economy in the short run. That has an impact on our living standards, has an impact on how much the government can then also spend in 5 years' time as well. So she's got a trade-off to face, and it's basically, does she want a bigger margin of error on Wednesday after she's announced all the tax increases, getting to somewhere about £30 or £40 billion, or does she risk calling the economy too much in her pursuit of getting that bigger margin of error? I think if you're, you know, if you're, like with anything like this, it depends on what stake you have in the economy. You know, if you're a bond trader, you probably want her to have a bit more fiscal headroom because it shows that the government's a bit more fiscally credible. The bonds which you own are probably going to retain your value. But if you're a taxpayer, or say, you know, you're someone who's on lower income and might receive benefits, or you're ill and you use the NHS quite frequently, you probably actually want her to have less fiscal headroom, because it means that the government's going to be spending quite a bit more and is going to be helping you as well. So I think with anything like this, like with any budget, there's always winners or losers. And I think it kind of depends on the perspective that you take from where you are in the economy.
How much of a mistake do you think it has been, if you think it's a mistake at all, to have such a long run-up to this budget?
It's awful. I mean, I think this is definitely getting on for nearly my maybe 15th or 16th event that I've covered. And this has been the worst run-up I've experienced. I think it's gone for too long. You know, we were talking about what was going to happen in the budget back in July, which is sort of unheard of in terms of the lead time of speculating about a budget.
So why did they leave it so late?
I think the sort of working theory amongst some economists is that they wanted to give the Office for Budget Responsibility a bit more time to assess some of the policies so they could probably give them a bit more credibility, because they're doing some stuff on, the government's going to announce some stuff on housing, house building, public investment. The OBR needs a bit of time to assess whether or not that's actually going to affect the economy, and then they'll feed that into the forecast. So that's kind of the working theory, is that they left it as late as possible to allow the OBR to do that work. But the flip side of that is, as obviously we've mentioned there, is that you just elongate the amount of time that people speculate about budget increases, and that is terrible for consumers, it's awful for businesses, because no one knows what's going to happen. You know, say for instance, if you were going to buy a house maybe in October time, why would you do that now? You would wait until after November. So you just get this very small, short period where the economy kind of gums up and doesn't really do anything for a couple of months. And that is a function of the government leaving it this late, and also, you know, leaking basically the majority of the budget to the newspapers and then you turning on income tax increase. So, yeah, in terms of the lead-up to this budget, it's been pretty, pretty awful, I'd say.
Well, we're going to talk about exactly that effect on all of our brains with a pollster in just a couple of moments' time. But you will be glad then when Wednesday is upon us. Will you sleep a wink on Tuesday night, Jack?
It's Christmas coming early. A little bit. I'll be having like the OBR's forecast on the top of my ceiling so I can look at the previous
your
one.
Fiscal stocking is bulging. Yeah. Jack, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We will hear more from Jack as the week progresses. So let's talk a little bit more about polling. We've got some new polling from More in Common showing that most people in Britain now think the UK is already in recession. Nearly 3 in 5 worry the cost of living crisis may never end. Let's talk to Luke Trill, who is UK Director of More in Common. Hello, Luke.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit more about what your polling has shown.
Well, it actually backs up a lot of what you were just discussing with Jack, that the public are very gloomy heading into this budget. They, as you said, more than half of the public think that the UK is in a recession at the moment. Now, of course, we're not in a technical recession, but it's a sign of how gloomy they are about the state of the economy. The top words that people use when we ask them to describe the economy are poor, struggling, stagnant, so not very optimistic there. And then I think the most important part of our polling, or perhaps the most worrying one, is that real pessimism, not just that we're in a bad state at the moment, but that we're going to struggle to get out of it. And we have the highest number that we have had since we started tracking, saying they do not think that the cost of living crisis will now ever end, and that they're having to make a series of personal cutbacks, from cutting down on luxuries to shopping around more to cutting back on holidays, to cope with it. And that, of course, in turn is feeding that miserable public mood.
Yeah, and none of that leads to growth, does it? And actually, just to flesh out exactly what you're saying there, 47% of people you polled say they're cutting down on luxuries to cope with cost of living crisis. 43% are going out less, 39% are cutting down on electricity or heating, and more than a fifth have gone into debt or borrowed from friends and families. I mean, that is a very poor state of personal financial health, isn't it, for so many people?
It is. And there, of course, the numbers that you're reading out now, but we also do focus groups where we talk to people around the country, and they describe, you know, how that cost of living crisis is affecting them, you know. And the lines that we get back from people are things like, you know, I just feel like I work to live, I live to work, I'm not able to take the kids out on day trips, I'm not living, I'm just surviving. You know, there's a real sense of misery from this. And of course, that is translating into anger with the government. And along with this polling today, we find that both Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer have reached their lowest approval rating that we've recorded for them. Keir Starmer on minus 51, Rachel Reeves on minus 52. So it does feel like, you know, if it's not quite last chance saloon, this budget, it's getting close to it for Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer in terms of public opinion. They've got to surely do something to surprise the public on the upside. It can't just be more gloom.
And Luke, how does it compare to when the Conservatives were in power? I mean, do people also believe that Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt would be doing a better job?
Yeah, so I mean, you've got to remember that hindsight is a sort of wonderful thing, and people tend, you know, to have a bit of recency bias. But actually, when we now ask people, who would you prefer as Chancellor, Rachel Reeves or Rishi Sunak? Rachel Reeves and Jeremy Hunt. Around 2/3 in both cases opt for Sunak and Hunt. Just 1/3 for Rachel Reeves. And we also ask, because obviously there was that big economic debate during the general election, we ask people, who do you think was closer to telling the truth on the economy during that general election and during those debates? And 60% of the public now say Rishi Sunak, just 40% say Keir Starmer. I think that will worry the government. But I think what might worry them more is around 3 in 10 of people who actually voted Labour now say that Rishi Sunak was closer to telling the truth there. So there really has been a change in perceptions of the government, in perceptions of their fortunes. It's not that the public don't think that the economy is in a mess. You can see that from the polling. But I think the difference is they're losing faith that this is the right government to sort things out. And part of that is, again, when we talk to people in focus groups, them saying, as Jack said just now, you know, why has there been so much stuff in the papers? It's happening, it's not happening. You know, it's felt quite chaotic to lots of people. And if there's one thing we know, it's that the public really, you know, feel like we've basically had political chaos since Brexit. They thought this government was going to put a stop to it. Clearly it hasn't. Mm.
It's quite interesting, Luke, that several of our listeners today have said, oh, just put some hikes on income tax. Just do it. Be brave about it. Get this out of the way. Put some more money in the bank. That's what's going to make us feel better. And that's a very different message from don't U-turn, don't be a hypocrite, don't take us to the polls in a general election saying one thing and 2 years down the line do something else. Can you poll on exactly that kind of disparity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I, you know, one of the things we know is that trust in politics is very low at the moment. And I think having made that pledge so central to their economic message during the election that they wouldn't raise taxes, I think it would have eroded trust even further. And one of the things we did in this polling actually was we asked people to rank or rate the severity of various sort of scandals or unpopular things governments had done. So the mini budget, Partygate, the PPE scandal, means testing winter fuel before they U-turned on it. And what we found was that breaking the manifesto tax pledge in people's eyes would have been worse, would have been seen as more damaging than any of those, though the mini budget, the PPE scandal, winter fuel. So I think it would have been not just a brave government, dare I say it, a government that did not have great hopes for its future prospects of survival had they broken that pledge. And, you know, there's an argument, should they have been braver during the election? Did they box themselves in too much there? And I think the data shows the public might have listened to them then. But having made the promise, it is then very hard to break it.
What does all of this mean for Reform and the Green Party? If the central parties can't deliver, yeah, then you've got to understand that people will look elsewhere, haven't you?
I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. It's not just now that people think, oh, you know, this Labour government's unpopular, that Conservative government was unpopular. People are starting to think that the system as a whole isn't delivering. And it's no surprise that those who are the most pessimistic are those who are now voting for Reform and the Greens. And they're people saying, look, you know, clearly there's a problem with the system itself. We need something new entirely. And the Reform Party and the Greens offer that to people. Now, you know, how credible their offers are for other people to debate, but there's no doubt that their sense of offering something totally new is resonating with a public that just don't think the status quo works for them.
Luke, always good to hear from you. Thank you very much indeed. Luke Trill is UK Director of More in Common, and you can hear Luke every Thursday evening in the polling station on Times Radio Drive with John.
Yep, he is an excellent contributor. And in a moment, we're going to hear from the CEO of Prostate Cancer Research UK. This is in the light of Lord Cameron's successful treatment for prostate cancer. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The Budget 2025 on Times Radio. This Wednesday afternoon, Hugo Rifkind will bring you the budget statement from Chancellor Rachel Reeves, live from 12:30, followed at 1 by Joe Coburn and Andrew Neil with a special budget programme featuring expert analysis on all the announcements. Then from 4, John Pienaar brings you Drive Live from Westminster with a full roundup of all the political reaction. The Budget 2025, this Wednesday afternoon on Times Radio.
The Furniture Village Black Friday sale. Huge savings on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture. But hurry, it ends soon.
Co-op members now get prices matched to Aldi. Hold on, no way. Okay then, so co-op members now get everyday essentials price matched to Aldi. Sign up and start saving. Co-op, owned by you, right by you.
I wasn't expecting that.
Co-op member prices matched versus comparable selected products at Aldi GB. Co-op membership required. Co-op group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk/Aldi price match.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Add water to your will. And know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
It's been one of the big talking points of the day, rightly. The former Prime Minister David Cameron has told The Times that he has been treated for prostate cancer. Now, Lord Cameron is joining campaigners who want screening for prostate cancer rolled out to men who are at higher risk. 12,000 men die of prostate cancer every year, but there has been a debate about just how effective a wider screening programme would be. Oliver Kemp is the Chief Executive of Prostate Cancer Research UK. Oliver Kemp, does your organisation have a view on the effectiveness of a screening programme?
Yes, we certainly do. We've been campaigning for targeted screening for the last 2 years, and we're very much in favour of rolling it out to black men and men with a family history, because we think it'll save the NHS money and save thousands of lives.
When you say a family history, is it a family history of cancer or a family history specifically of prostate cancer?
So particularly prostate cancer, but also there are really strong links between breast and ovarian cancer and prostate cancer. So you're more likely to get prostate cancer if your mother has had breast cancer or ovarian cancer, for example.
Really? I had no idea about that. Is that widely known?
I don't think so. I mean, it's the BRCA gene. It's the Angelina Jolie gene that's the one that causes all the problems.
And why is there that link exactly?
It's just a genetic mutation that causes the cancer to grow and be more aggressive. So some people have the genetic mutation and some don't. So if they have that genetic mutation, you're more likely to get it and you're more likely to have an aggressive form of the disease, unfortunately.
Right. I'm sure there are lots of people who've taken note of what Lord Cameron has, you know, by the way, very bravely said today. But why is it that Lithuania is the only country on earth with, at the moment, a PSA screening programme?
So in the past, we've had there's been really significant concerns about over-treatment. So this is when people have their prostates taken out with whatever means and they didn't need it. And obviously that causes a great deal of harm because of you're taking out a prostate and it might lead you incontinence and impotence. So there has traditionally been a lot of harm, and there's a lot of harm associated with kind of quite aggressive diagnostic tests. And thankfully, we don't need a digital rectal exam anymore to find prostate cancer. All the tests have changed and all the treatments.
OK, I think that's really important, and I hope people don't mind us being frank. But do you think that in the past, that fear of the examination was actually putting a substantial number of men off the whole idea of getting a checkup?
Yeah, and unfortunately, it still does. People still think they might have a digital rectal exam, and it's a really bad way of finding prostate cancer. The prostate's like a walnut, and if you have cancer on the other side of the walnut, then nobody's going to feel it. So, yes, definitely, we still hear it in this day and age that people are worried about having a digital rectal exam, and it should not be the way in which prostate cancer is found. Now, it's a simple blood test followed by an MRI.
Right, OK. But presumably there must be some quite invasive treatment at some point.
Yeah, so if cancer is found and you've got prostate cancer that is growing quickly, then, yes, often you'll end up in surgery and you'll have a radical prostatectomy to take the prostate out. So, yeah, that would be what would be called over-treatment if the prostate never needed to be taken out in the first place. And that used to happen a lot, but obviously with diagnostics improving and us knowing whether you've got aggressive forms of cancer or not, that has reduced dramatically in the last few years.
Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of treatment that Lord Cameron has said he had? Focal therapy. What is that?
So it's a very targeted treatment. It's one that's often for quite early stages of the disease before it's spread. And it's just a way of making sure that you reduce those that likelihood of someone being incontinent and impotent. It just directs the treatment directly where the cancer is rather than having to take out the entire prostate.
I see. And people might be thinking, legitimately or not, well, look, you know, former prime ministers probably get special treatment. Could any man get this therapy?
So it's more prevalent in the south of the country. There are more places doing focal therapy in the south, but there's quite a lot and it's expanding across the country. So unfortunately, yes, it's a little bit of a postcode lottery. And one of the things we really want to be able to do, and one of the things we want to talk about, is making sure that we have equitable access to treatments, because we see such significant differences, especially for people in their late 70s, to getting access to the latest diagnostics and the latest treatments.
Right. So frankly, they're more likely to survive.
Yeah, frankly, they're more likely to have their cancer caught. We can often find that people who are older get their cancer caught later. People in certain parts of the country, if you're in Scotland, you're almost three times as much chance of getting a cancer caught late than if you're in the south of England. And then you've got different qualities of treatment being offered as well. So we do see a significant postcode lottery.
Right, OK. The whole point is, a lot of people feel that to be told that you are ill, that you've got cancer, even though it might be a form of cancer that will not kill you, though you may die with it, it's actually going to ruin some of the best years of your life. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I think if cancer is going to grow fast in your body, you're going to find out one way or another. And it's far better to catch it early when you've got 100% chance of survival and the treatments are getting better, rather than catch it late and have the metastases, the spread of cancer around your body, which often, like Sir Chris Hoyer, very unfortunately, is spreading into his bones. And that's a really awful disease when it gets to that stage.
Right, but it shouldn't have happened to Chris Hoy, should it? Was he just desperately unlucky, or was he one of those individuals who, for whatever reason, and I'm in no way blaming him, ignored some signals?
Well, I mean, he had no symptoms until he'd got back pain, which obviously when it started to spread out of his prostate, and he was 48. And we've been calling for a screening from 45 for men with a family history, and Chris has family history. So if he'd had a PSA test at 45, there would have been a very high likelihood chance of him catching it, because he would have gone 45, 46, and there's a 6 in 7 chance of a PSA test catching a prostate cancer. And he could have been caught stage 1, where there's 100% chance of survival.
Right. I mean, it's really stark when you put it like that. So very briefly, Oliver, just run through any of the warning signs that any man needs to be aware of.
So often bladder problems, so not being peeing through the night, having to go regularly. And the other one is not being able to fully empty your bladder. So if you're seeing those things, then please go and see your doctor.
So we're being very specific, because I think we have to be. When you say you can't empty it, you feel there's more, but it hasn't emerged. Is that right?
That's exactly it.
Kind you of sense
little,
it.
Little dribble at the end and not quite fully feeling like your bladder is completely empty, exactly that.
Okay, and this can happen at any age after?
Yes, I guess after 50, it gets much more likely, and the average age of being diagnosed is 64.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. I hope that's clear to everybody. Oliver Kemp is the Chief Executive of Prostate Cancer Research UK.
Sensible messaging worth listening to. I'd just like to take you back to our conversation about polling and what's coming at us in the budget. MJ says your interviewee on polls is wrong. The no U-turn for Rory was whipped up and talked up by the media. Most voters would accept a change to a manifesto faced by a change in the facts. Saying income tax rates are going up and that's that would have resonated with the electorate, as would dealing with unpopular welfare reforms. Get the money, then you can focus on being a party of action. From our very random and by no means forensic polling via our listeners this afternoon, Jane, they are saying just do something big and we will all lump it together, learn to get on with it, and maybe that's a better way forward.
Well, that's what they're saying now. But let's see what they're saying.
Have you no faith?
No, not much.
Okay.
What am I saying?
0333 003 2353 is our number this afternoon. The very best book recommendations from the Times and Sunday Times literary editor. Those come your way in a couple of moments' time. It's just gone 3:30. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The business secretary has admitted that Labour's tax rises have led to an exodus of wealthy Britons. Peter Kyle says he accepts that some of the decisions the party has made since taking office last year have caused some people to feel the need to leave. Rachel Reeves is expected to announce significant tax rises in her budget on Wednesday. Economist Andrew Sentence is a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. He's told Times Radio that Reeves is trapped because of what she did in her first budget last year.
Her public spending totals came up at about £100 billion higher for the coming year than the previous government was planning to spend. Now, if you're planning to spend £100 billion and you only raise £40 billion extra in taxes, which is what she did in her last budget, you're going to have a gap. You can have a debate about how big the gap is, but you're still going to have a gap.
The Prime Minister says progress is being made in talks on a peace plan for Ukraine. Talks have been held in Geneva. Sir Keir Starmer says the Coalition of the Willing will meet virtually tomorrow. And two peers will be suspended from the House of Lords after an undercover sting found they had breached the code of conduct. Lord Dannatt faces 4 months off and Lord Evans of Watford 5 months off for providing parliamentary services for financial gain. It follows investigations triggered by journalists. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix Kitchen Gallery or try the Matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk.
So we had news today that Jimmy Cliff has died at the age of 81, a two-time Grammy-winning artist with a career spanning six decades. He was awarded the Jamaican Order of Merit in 2003. Let's sit back for a minute and a half and have a listen to some of his hits.
Gonna be a
succeed at last.
Just some of the magic of Jimmy Cliff, who said of his own work, "The essence of my music is struggle. What gives it the icing is the hope of love." His wife posted news of his death from complications after pneumonia. Pop trivia alert. His 1985 album had one of the best titles ever. Do you know what it was?
I don't. Go on.
Do you know what it was, Robbie Millen?
No, I don't.
Cliffhanger.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that is,
isn't it?
It's a pun.
Isn't it? It is.
Some great songs there. MPs are hearing evidence from BBC figures at the heart of the scandal that led to the resignation of the corporation's director general. It also triggered a threat to sue for as much as $5 billion by President Trump after a speech of his was edited misleadingly. MPs are also hearing from former editorial standards advisers, including Michael Prescott. Now, he's the man who wrote the report on BBC editorial failures that kicked off the scandal.
And what was especially troubling about this was that it was all happening just at the time when the BBC faces this fabulous once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, because in the era of fake news, the BBC really can become the go-to provider of news for the entire world. I think that's something that could happen. I would like it to happen, but it can only happen successfully if the BBC, I think, does a better job addressing these incipient and growing problems of the type that the Standards Committee kept identifying. And that's why I tried to alert.
Right, well, that gives you some idea of what's been going on at Parliament this afternoon. That was Michael Prescott. Later on, the BBC chair, Samir Shah, and non-exec director Sir Robbie Gibb and Caroline Thompson will also be questioned by MPs on that committee.
Robbie Millen is in the studio to talk us through his choice of books for the week. A very good afternoon to you, Robbie. You're going to start with something that you want to eulogise about, and Jane and I just aren't so sure. So take the floor.
But as soon as I said the book that I'd been reading, you both rolled your eyes. I felt very small. But I know it's a bit ridiculous me saying, "Have you heard of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens?" But you know what? I've never read it before. You know, with certain books you think you don't have to read because they're kind of in the ether. We've all seen the films and things like that. But you know, it's really very good. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised, but Charles Dickens, blinking good writer. I mean, look at this description of Scrooge. "A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster." Now, my main complaint about most modern novels is that they're all kind of very minimalist. Mm. You know, it's all about, the clever people say, it's all about the blank spaces on the page. And Charles Dickens has
no nonsense.
He's going to describe it. And every page there's something on. Like, there's a description of the house that Scrooge lives in, which is down an alleyway, kind of miserable little alleyway. And he says something like this. It was down an alleyway. It had so little business to be that one could scarcely help fancying it must have run there when it was a young house, playing at hide-and-seek with other houses and forgotten the way out again. And you just think, a little one-line tossed off.
Little moments of genius. Okay.
So this is my plea now, writers, grotesque characters, lots of detail.
And A Christmas Carol is one of Dickens' shorter works, yeah,
exactly.
Isn't it?
That's why I'm reading it.
Okay. How short is it?
It's only 90 pages.
Oh. Yeah.
But exactly. Now you'll read it. Now you know it's so short.
So we did have a listener earlier on who said that they read it every Christmas.
Yeah.
It's their absolute little go-to book.
Absolutely.
To reread and take you into the Christmas moments.
The Times cartoonist Peter Brooks always does this. And not only that, I was talking to our chief literary critic, who's got an 11-year-old son, who's reading at the moment for school, and started off as kind of grumbling because it was sort of old and fashioned and stuffy, and is now completely switched on to English literature, all down to Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol.
Okay, so
that's, there we go.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to reread it then. I know that I did read it when I was much, much younger.
Exactly.
But I think, you know, sometimes you just have to discount what you were made to read.
Exactly.
And go back to it of your own volition.
You can rip through it in an afternoon.
Okay.
Though it's taken me longer.
The listener who reads it every year is Stephen Dorset. So, happy Christmas, Steve.
Yes, yeah. Smart guy.
Okay.
Very smart.
Can we say the same for Margaret Atwood's Book of Lives, A Memoir of Sorts?
Oh, yes. No, again, it's It's quite a big book, about 500 pages, but it's great fun because Margaret Atwood, who's, I think, now 86, just turned 86, very much in her anecdotage. She doesn't take herself at all seriously, so she plays, you know, plenty of jokes about herself. And sometimes I think she forgets that she's a writer, you know, written novels, because occasionally she may, oh, then I wrote this novel, which did rather well, like The Handmaid's Tale and things like that. But it's quite fun because it gives her, the story of a, you know, her as a young writer or as a child. As she says, she was a flat-chested weirdo who just liked insects, and then all of a sudden she discovered boys. I mean, you know, she's supposed to be a great feminist. She said, oh, you won't be, you know, age 9 at school with girls puts you off feminism.
So she's funnier than you might expect.
I've seen her perform, you know, literary festival, and she has this beguiling presence because she looks a little bit kind of witchy, which she plays on, and she's got that very slow Canadian delivery. Mm. But she bewitches her audience, and she definitely has a big sort of fan club. She's a very charismatic person.
Yeah, I was thinking of The Handmaid's Tale when I was watching the Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe drama last night on the BBC. Oh dear, I mean, absolutely brilliant stuff, but hard watch. And yes, I mean, it did remind you of, well, they always say, don't they? Well, she always says, everything she's written has actually happened somewhere in the world.
Exactly, and this is the power of fiction, because it kind of escapes just the here and now and can be sort of transferred to anywhere. Yeah. With the power of imagination.
So is this a new memoir that she's brought out?
Yes, it came out a couple of weeks ago. Okay. So it's it's very much, it covers her life. I mean, she has this great long love affair with her partner, Graham Gibson, who died, I think, the year she won the Booker Prize for The Testament. So it was a kind of a difficult year for her. But it's just, I like anyone that sort of jumps along and tells a joke about herself.
Yeah, definitely. Finally, the only grandchild of Oscar Wilde, Merlin Holland, has just published After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal.
Now, isn't it extraordinary? So Oscar Wilde died in 1900. Obviously, the great Sondermite affair was at 1895. But isn't it amazing that one of his grandsons is still alive, who's just, obviously never met. They never met, but he's just turned 80, or next month turns 80.
Right.
And it's really about living with the kind of legacy of having Oscar Wilde as your grandfather. So for many years, I mean, his grandmother, Constance, who was married to Oscar Wilde, the first thing she did was change the family name away from Wilde to Holland in order to sort of protect her two sons. I mean, her eldest son, I think, died in the First World War, took a bullet from a German sniper. But Merlin Holland's father, Vivian, survived and lived on. But it was always, there's a little sort of story in the book about how when Vivian was at school, he once sort of ran off into, it was a very snowy day, ran off into to lie in a snowdrift and hoped he might sort of die in the cold because of that kind of toxic legacy he was dealing with, a mixture of prejudice and just knowing that there was something wrong with your family, that this terrible thing had happened.
So does Merlin then talk about how all of that must have changed for him later in his life to become so much more of a cause célèbre and something to be proud of?
Yeah, up to a point, because I think his Merlin's mother, for a period when Vivian had died, tried to sort of edit his diaries out. She was unhappy with all the link between Oscar Wilde and homosexuality. So it wasn't gay. It was, you know, it's all these pansies putting it around. And she tried to kind of essentially erase her husband's diaries in order to maintain the kind of idea of this playwright who was just a victim of kind of scuttlebucket and things like that. So it's not any... The idea we have of Oscar Wilde now is this kind of almost like a martyr. It took a long time to get there.
And his grave is in... Is it Paris?
Yes. Yeah. What's the famous... I've forgotten the name.
It is famous.
Yes.
But they've had to put perspex around.
That's right. Yeah, people sort of kissing it, or used to kiss it a lot. Because, Merlin Holland also is often invited to sort of gay rights gatherings because he kind of this, like, grandson of a secular saint. And then again, that's sort of difficult when people want to project onto your long dead grandfather, what he would think. Yes, you've never met.
But that would be so difficult when you know that the life your family has led has been one of pain because of prejudice.
Yes, absolutely.
To then be the one who's allowed to kind of take a round of applause would be a very difficult thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Gosh, you're a sensitive, empathetic person.
She's not. No, she is. But we should say that
Jane hates it when people say things like that, Bobby. The importance of being earnest is on in the West End now, isn't it?
I mean, is it,
it's always on.
It's always, exactly.
Stephen Fry's in it. People are piling in to see it. I mean, Oscar Wilde, you can't hear this, but he is having the last laugh. Isn't
I think
he?
So.
I hope
well,
so.
He's not enjoying the royalties, is he? It's not all going his way.
No.
But isn't it strange? Immediately you think of the name Oscar Wilde, you immediately think either Stephen Fry or Rupert Everett, both terrific actors who sort of caught something of him.
Yeah.
And his immense corpulence in old age.
Right. Was he?
Well, he was quite large. She wasn't that old.
No, I think he was 40. He was 45 or 40,
something. 47, I
okay,
think.
Okay, really? Gosh, no age at all. Robbie, it's always a delight to see you. Thank you very much indeed. You are going to be entertaining the masses on board a cruise ship in the name of the Times
ocean
and Sunday
liner.
Times. An ocean liner.
Yes.
We got that wrong last year.
Yes.
We did. Yeah. It's not a cruise, it's a crossing.
It's a crossing. Yes, okay. It's the Cheltenham Literature Festival at Sea.
Okay. Tickets still available? I shouldn't think so for one minute.
But it's going to be
sold out months ago.
The weather is gorgeous at this time of year.
Isn't it lovely? You take your bikinis, send us some pictures. We've been discussing A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, Margaret Atwood's Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts, and After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal by his grandson, Merlin Holland. Thank you, Robbie.
And after an excruciating amount of faffing about, we are this week going to record our book club podcast.
Oh, yes.
On
Wednesday.
Yeah, on Wednesday. But the book is Patty Smith. To be fair, you couldn't have known what I meant.
More of a timetable question there.
Patty Smith's Just Kids. Now, have you read that, Robbie?
No, I haven't.
Can that suggest
but
that...
I'm already trembling with excitement at listening to it.
I bet. Well, what is it you said earlier about that book? It's divided opinion.
Yes. It's got what we used to call in local radio. In fact, we were banned from saying in local radio. It's had a mixed reaction. It's a very lame way of putting it. Thank you, Robbie.
Right. 10 to 4. What might the budget mean for the money in your pocket? Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
What good is sitting?
Winning a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards, Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club is still the best musical in London, says the Daily Telegraph.
Life is a cabaret, chum.
The most electrifying night out starts the minute you step inside. Outside it is winter, but in here it is so hot. So right this way, your stage side table is waiting. Book your tickets for a perfectly marvellous gift this Christmas at KitKat.club.
Add water to your will. And know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Nice. Direct Line just sorted me a courtesy van while they're fixing mine after my accident. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like clients paying you on time. All done.
Brilliant. Your invoice is all paid up, left you 5-star reviews. Oh, and a bit extra in there for staying late that time. And I baked this cake for you too.
Nice.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Comprehensive cover required. Courtesy van limited for up to 21 days if your van is written off, stolen or you use your own repairer. Excludes windscreen claims.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
MJ says, have either of you seen Christmas Karma? It's Christmas Carol crossed with an Indian musical. Looks hilarious and feel good. I've heard of it, and I'm going to the cinema tonight, so I might see a trailer for it. I'll report back.
Okay.
And what's this? Sam says, yes, Fee is sensitive and empathetic. She seems genuinely to be that way.
You're going to hate me even more, yeah. Mike, by 4 o'clock. And can we just do Christine? Yeah,
Christine is funny.
Oh, fantastic.
Just describe what she
said. Well,
sent.
So Christine has sent us a photograph of Oscar Wilde's grave in the Père Lachaise Cemetery. So Jane and I opened it eagerly. And in fact, it's the rather well-worn bust, an emphasis on the bust there, of a chanteur is called Dalida, yeah. And obviously people have gone past, and I mean, this being France, they've touched the statue in a certain way, so there are certain appendages that are slightly more shiny than other parts of her body. It's not Oscar Wilde, as Christine follows up with a text saying, sorry, wrong pick.
Thank you, Christine. We admire your enthusiasm. No, seriously, thank you. Made us laugh. The Chancellor delivers her budget on Wednesday. Who didn't know that, by the way? And the stakes are high. Who didn't know that? Pressure on public services, questions over tax cuts and the economic outlook looking fragile. Barely an hour goes by without another leak on the changing plans of what Rachel Reeves might or might not do. Let's bring in our money man, Adam Shaw. It's always interesting, Adam, that the changes announced on Budget Day can take quite a while to work their way into the system. It's not instant, is it, much of this stuff?
Well, yes and no. Some of it is instant. It's a good question, actually, about the process of what happens. Some things are actually pushed through immediately. And I seem to remember, I think, when, the sort of tax on beer and whiskey and stuff was going up to stop people rushing out and just loading up for the next year, those things tended to be pushed through very quickly. But the bulk of policies announced in the budget wait effectively for what's called the finance bill, which has to move through Parliament. But it is an all or nothing thing. I mean, it gets passed because it's widely expected that if it doesn't get passed, this isn't just another piece of legislation. The government would fall. But yes, you're quite right. Most of the time, this takes a little while. But it's a very apt question to ask because given things like the expectation that she might restrict the amount of money you can put into a cash ISA, for instance. I think a lot of people have been opening up cash ISAs and funding them as much as they can. And it would be interesting to see if she does announce that there are restrictions on ISAs, whether it's then too late to do anything about it, or you've got still a little bit of time to get it in before the legislation passes.
OK, now the mansion tax, which we still don't know is a definite for the budget on Wednesday, but much discussed today. If it does happen, it won't be for a couple of years. And there's quite a lot to get through before any of that can come into fruition.
Yes, it's technically, I think, a very difficult tax to introduce because you've got to value lots of homes as well. It'll have huge amounts of impact. One thing I just want to say about the mansion tax is that I think, I mean, you talk about the mansion tax, all journalists talk about the mansion tax. I think we've been sucked into this terminology by adopting the words of government. And I think we shouldn't really, because it sort of comes value laden that, oh, it's for people who own mansions. Well, what is a mansion? In fact, I think, you know, what they're talking about is homes worth over 2 million. That is certainly a lot of money. In London, you quite often find homes for 1 million, which don't look anything like a mansion. It's a property tax. And I think calling it a mansion tax is part of the politics of what's going on. And that they're trying to say, this is not for you. This is nothing to do with ordinary people. This is billionaires. And actually, if we looked at £2 million, for instance, I think the latest figures show there are 160,000 homes in the UK over £2 million and many more over a million as well. But the terminology of it aside, I think it will be a big, big issue because if it does get pushed through, the huge problem is that you may live in a £2 million home, but have very little cash to spend. And if you've got to come up with a bill, for instance, 1% on a £3 million home is 10,000 quid each year. Where is that 10,000 quid going to come from? And people may well feel this is a wealth tax by any other means. I've saved my money. I've put it into my house as a sort of savings tool. And now you're taking that away from me. So regardless of the technical problems here, I think it's a huge emotional issue for this country.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely got people feverishly excited today, and I mean excited in the sense that they're frankly quite worried. Let's talk about the whole issue of a budget. Do other democracies behave like this every year and have this big set piece fiscal event?
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a set piece, isn't it? It's a piece of parliamentary theatre. And the answer is no. In some ways, we're very unusual. And we don't really talk about that. We sort of just accept it as part of the political and financial landscape. Because the budget comes to Parliament as a done deal. It's not up for discussion. And MPs have a binary option. You accept it or you don't accept it and the government falls. For instance, in the US, it's much more the start of a negotiation. And I've heard it described as a sort of three-tier cake where they put in a bit just to fly a flag and they don't think we'll get through the main bit. Well, there's negotiations over and the bottom tier of that cake is going to be accepted. But it is a process in which there is some democratic, if you like, input into it. That's not how we do it in the UK. And indeed, even Parliament's own House of Commons Library published a report saying, in international terms, we don't rate very well, actually, on the financial scrutiny we allow Parliament to have on the budget. So I think that is a really interesting and perhaps not a very good way about going about things. And it relates, I think, to the amount, like, huge amounts of leaks we've seen this year. And actually, I think what's going on, and these are not leaks in my view, these are probably authorised sort of testing of the water.
Right. Some people have called it kite flying. We had a WhatsApp from a listener earlier who just said the government are doing all these leaks as kind of free market research, their ideas go down.
Yeah, I think of it a bit like the wiki budget. You put out something and you get lots of input from people. And in a curious way, that's a democratic process, isn't it? That what they're trying to do is go, how crazy is everybody go if we do this? And, and so therefore they are sort of getting a bit of input into things through these leaks. And indeed, we've seen very dramatic changes in what we expect the Chancellor to be doing on Wednesday because, I think, of what's actually been happening with those leaks and the responses to them.
OK, so how does Adam Shaw spend Budget Day?
Yes, very good question. I will be watching the budget. I used to cover the budget for the BBC. They're nightmare things to do because they speak very quickly and announce huge amounts of numbers. And I was forever desperately writing down the numbers, thinking, have I written down, is it umpteen billion? Is it, what was that, billion, million? And they do that on purpose because I think what they want you, they don't really want you to have a proper analysis of it. You're having to be led by the politics and what the Chancellor wants you to report. And actually, the proper analysis comes out 2 or 3 days' time when everyone's managed to have a look at the detail of it. They're a bit of a nightmare to cover, to be honest.
Thank you, Adam. Have a good week. We'll talk to you next Monday. Of course, what he meant to say was that he'll be spending Budget Day in the company of Andrew Neil and Joe Coburn here on Times Radio. He has written a budget briefing. You can find it at www.themoneydoctor.tv and on his socials at Adam Shaw Biz.
Our producer today, Hugo Chambray, our tech operator, Adam Heaton. Up next, John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The Business Secretary, Peter Carl, admits Labour's tax rises have seen entrepreneurs leaving the UK. And Keir Starmer says progress is being made in Ukraine peace talks. As it's reported, Ukraine and the US have a new 19-point plan. And coming up, we'll bring you the latest on those negotiations. I'll get the view of a French senator, a former US ambassador in Kyiv, as well as a former Russian prime minister. And we'll be keeping you across all the action in Parliament as MPs hear evidence from the BBC chairman and a member of the executive board discussing the Panorama editing row. Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The business secretary has admitted that people wanting to start a company are leaving Britain, quote, in droves. Peter Kyle says many have gone to the US because the conditions were not right in the UK. He says it's concerning that some entrepreneurs feel they have to leave in order to succeed. Chancellor Rachel Reeves is expected to announce significant tax rises in her budget on Wednesday, while Sky News is reporting that the Office for Budget Responsibility will downgrade its growth forecast until 2029. More on this from Times Economics correspondent Jack Barnett.
The economic forecast has changed quite rapidly since the previous fiscal statement, which was in March time. It's deteriorated quite sharply since then. It means that the OBR thinks that the government is not going to raise as much in tax as it thought previously in 5 years' time. That's pushed the headroom from £9.9 billion surplus down to about a £10 billion deficit. Chancellor needs to replenish that with tax increases.
Donald Trump has said that something good just may be happening on talks to end the war in Ukraine. He suggested on social media that big progress is being made. There are concerns, though, that a 28-point peace plan would be extremely difficult for Ukraine to accept. Talks are being held in Geneva and the Coalition of the Willing is meeting tomorrow. Sakir Starmer says things are moving in the right direction.
We are making progress, and that is a good thing. Everybody is absolutely focused on what we need to get out of this, and that is a just and lasting peace. Both of those words matter. It's got to be just, and obviously matters for Ukraine have to be determined by Ukraine. But it's also got to be lasting. It's got to endure. So that's the focus.
Two members of the House of Lords are set to be suspended over breaches of the Code of Conduct. In separate investigations, Lord Dannatt and Lord Evans of Watford were both found to have broken the rules on providing parliamentary services in return for payment or reward. Almost 4,000 cyber-flashing crimes have been recorded by police in England and Wales since it became an offence last year. London had the most incidents, followed by the West Midlands and then Essex. It's when someone exposes themselves in a digital communication. Campaigners say the high number of offences shows there's a growing awareness of the crime. David Cameron has revealed to The Times he's been treated for prostate cancer. He's joining campaigners who want screening for the disease given to men who are at a higher risk. 12,000 men die of prostate cancer every year. And the musician Jimmy Cliff has died at the age of 81. He's credited as being one of the main voices to bring reggae to a global audience. His songs included Wonderful World, Beautiful People, and You Can Get It If You Really Want. He also starred in the 1972 crime drama The Harder They Come. His wife, Latifa Chambers, said he'd been suffering from pneumonia. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for The Times News Briefing on The Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with IG.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, after 3 days of frantic diplomacy, with the emphasis on frantic, there's been a new draft plan for peace in Ukraine drawn up between Russia and the USA. Then Ukraine got involved, and that plan was torn up. Now, there's reportedly a new US-Ukraine plan, 19 points of it, though not enough points to deal with the biggest ones of all. Which country controls what areas of territory, for example, in Ukraine's relations with NATO? Now, that is meant to be thrashed out between Presidents Trump and Putin, if they can. There's also a European plan, also discussed with Ukraine, and that's 28 points. Not sure what it adds up to, mind you, since Moscow's just dismissed that one as completely unconstructive. And you'll be forgiven for thinking it all sounds pretty pointless so far, but President Trump is reporting great progress. Volodymyr Zelensky is sounding positive too, though presumably he can't afford to get on Donald Trump's bad side, not after Trump told a journalist that Zelensky would have to strike terms or be left to, in his words, fight his little heart out. And Keir Starmer's sounding positive too, for what that may be worth. And Vladimir Putin? Well, everyone is waiting for his latest word, waiting while he sits in Moscow, launching waves of strike against Ukraine and seeing how far he can persuade President Trump to take his side and force everyone else to offer Russia concessions. Now, I'm going to get you up to date with this story in a moment. If there's any reason for optimism, well, let's at least try to find it. I wonder if you are optimistic about peace. Anybody? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. And here, BBC bosses are giving evidence now to a committee of MPs about the accusations and the denials of bias which have landed the Beeb in its latest crisis. And we'll have more on that for you a little while later. Now then, the US and Ukraine, as I say, reported to have drafted a new 19-point deal, left most of the politically sensitive elements to be decided by the leaders of the US and Ukraine. That's according to Ukraine's Deputy Foreign Minister. Serhii Kislyts was at the talks in Geneva, which have now ended. And speaking this morning, Keir Starmer said a just and lasting peace is the focus of the discussions.
There's more work to do. As you know, along with President Macron, I've been leading the Coalition of the Willing, which is a group of countries that have put in place support for Ukraine, particularly capability. And I'm now planning that we will meet virtually tomorrow. So we will host a Coalition of the Willing call to further discuss the progress that is being made, and I hope can be made, towards the thing that matters above all else, which is a just and lasting peace, which matters for Ukraine, but it also matters for all of us, because the conflict in Ukraine has had a direct impact here in the United Kingdom. So progress, yes, more work to do, but we've all got our sleeves rolled up, ready to put in those hard yards, hopefully to get to the right outcome.
Keir Starmer speaking earlier. Now, meanwhile, the Kremlin has said the European counter-proposal for peace appears unconstructive and will not work for Moscow. They say the original US plan had many acceptable provisions. Now, you might remember that was the plan before the weekend that was seen as effectively a surrender by Ukraine to Moscow. President Zelensky, he's been speaking about Ukraine's priorities this afternoon in Sweden.
Respect for human life, no changing borders by force, and no spheres of influence, applied term used to cover the desire to dominate other nations and wage wars of aggression.
That's President Zelensky speaking earlier. Now let's get the thoughts of Tim Marshall, former foreign correspondent and the author of the book Prisoners of Geography. Hi to you, Tim.
Hello there, John.
Welcome, as always. Should we just try and untangle this a little bit further? We've got Ukraine talking to America. You've got Ukraine having been talking to its friends in Europe. Do you see any reason, as of now, to be any more optimistic than in the past about a peace agreement that respects Ukraine's sovereignty and security?
None whatsoever. Not on any of the three plans that are out there. And before I go further, John, we've really got to deal with what the Prime Minister just said. He repeats over and again a just